My name is Dane Salter. I'm the Young Adults and Men's Minister. If I haven't met you yet, welcome. There's several first-time people here, so glad that you are here. If you've never been with us, our hope for this space is that this would be a place for you to rest. This would be a place for you to connect, both with God and with others. And it's a place that you would be refreshed by God's truth. So this semester, we've actually been in a series discussing God, love, sex, and purpose. Just some light, easy topics. So glad you came to check us out tonight, right? We're doing this because studies show that what I've heard from many of you is true. That rather than fun and exciting, modern dating has largely become confusing and frustrating and heartbreaking. And in a world that's saturated by dating apps and flooded with social media and movies and ads, all telling us that the most important thing about our lives is our relational status, we have lost a sense of dignity, of identity, and purpose when it comes to navigating romance, love, and even sexuality in our world. And I think we can all agree we need a better way, right? Thankfully, a better way does exist. And this better way isn't found in some new dating strategy. It's not in some insights from a TED Talk or some new TikTok trend. No, this better way actually comes from a short book of wisdom found in the Old Testament book of the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And in this book, as we've journeyed through it, we've watched this couple as they've navigated the seasons of singleness, of dating and engagement and marriage in a way that doesn't bring shame, confusion, or regret, but actually restores dignity, actually affirms identity, celebrates clarity and safety, and invites us to do the same. So we've titled this series Boundless Love because no matter what season of life we're in, we don't believe that God's ultimate good for us is contained in just one season or one relationship ideal alone, but that every season of our lives is an opportunity to both experience and extend God's love in a powerful and unique way, both for ourselves and for other people. Well, tonight we're going to dive straight in because we have a lot to cover, okay? But before we do, I'm going to warn you, our text tonight is a little spicy, okay? On a Thai food scale, we're going to be at like a 4, okay? Like maybe a 5. So it's going to get heated, all right? We might take a little break midway and go enjoy the cool air outside. I don't know. But throughout this book, this young couple has not been shy about their sexual desire for one another. We've seen how as their emotional vulnerability and relational intimacy begins to grow, so too does their desire to be physically intimate with each other. I mean, literally, the very first words we see in chapter 1, verse 2 were, "Oh, how I wish you would kiss me passionately." They just kind of dive right in there, right? And this isn't a bad thing. In fact, this is how God actually designed us. You see, way back in Genesis, when God made our first parents, Adam and Eve, he created us as relational, sexual beings. We were made to be in relationship with each other, both emotionally in our friendships and in marriage, and familially. The family construct is actually a picture of what God is going to do in the church. But God also designed us as sexual beings. We have physical bodies with physical differences, and we have physical desires that are tied to our emotions. What was the first command that God gave Adam and Eve when he made them in the garden? It wasn't don't touch, it was be fruitful and multiply. Hey, enjoy my creation, have sex, reproduce. From the very beginning, God wanted us to see that our desires for sex and physical intimacy, it's not shameful. It's good. And we see this celebrated in the Song of Solomon. At the same time, we also see the same warning pop up again and again throughout this couple's journey together. Again and again, it says, "Do not awaken or arouse love until it pleases. They recognize and admit their desires in an unashamed way, but they don't immediately act on them. They restrain them. They wait until the time is right. Now, what time is that? Why is that the right time and not before? Hey, these are all excellent questions. That's kind of where we're going tonight. Last time we were together, we finished up chapter 3, and we watched as this young couple moved from dating to its ultimate goal in marriage. Previously in chapter 2, in the first part of chapter 3, we talked about dating, and we said, hey, dating is meant to be a time of excitement and fun as we get to learn about each other. But dating isn't just a means unto itself. It's not just something we do because we feel lonely. It's not something we do to pass the time. And it's not something we do to keep up with our friends who are dating. Dating serves a specific purpose. We said it's a time of evaluation, right? Of asking yourself if this is the kind of person that you could potentially see yourself marrying one day. Are they safe? Are they dependable? Can I trust them? Can I trust them with the hard things as well as the joyful things? Are we encouraging and shaping each other to be better people, or are we just pulling each other further away from who God has called us to be? And so we've watched this couple. We've watched them wait. We've watched them date. We've watched them wait some more until tonight. At last, the time of waiting has come to an end, and where chapter 3 ended with their wedding, chapter 4 picks up after the ceremony with their wedding night. And so tonight, we're going to get a description of their first night together as this new creation under God, as man and wife. And we're going to walk through this text and watch as they begin to explore their sexuality together. But before we do, I just want to acknowledge the elephant in the room. We all have a story, right? Every single one of us has a story. And there are parts of our story that we love. There are parts of our story that actually make us weep. There are parts of our story that we'd really rather not think too deeply about if we had a choice. And I would acknowledge that this topic tonight of sex and sexuality, it's incredibly complex and messy. And sometimes that complexity and that mess can bring a lot of pain. Tragically, a lot of the pain and the shame and the confusion around this topic comes from things that we've heard, that we've seen, and that we've experienced in and around church settings. And so when we hear someone bring up the topics of sex and sexuality in a Christian setting, we can get a little nervous. Our heart can start to race a little bit, either because it honestly just seems so painfully awkward, or because it brings up our own past wounds. But to not talk about sex, especially in these settings, is utterly detrimental. It's a lot like a story I recently heard about an explorer. He was out in this remote jungle, and he was on the banks of the river, and he saw as a crocodile literally pulled a young man into the river. And so he ran back to the village and was like, oh my gosh, guys, I just saw this thing. We need to go out. We need to go help. We need to at least put some ropes up or something. Like, this is a dangerous thing. And no one did anything. They all just kind of watched and ignored him. And finally, one of the village elders came up to him and pulled him aside and said, hey, you need to stop talking about these crocodiles. We know about the crocodiles. But in our culture, we've decided it's a lot better to just not address it because it just brings up so much pain. And he looked around the village, and he saw people who were missing limbs, who were missing family members, who had scars from these attacks. And he was heartbroken to see that nothing could be done to stop this because no one was willing to have the conversation. The same is true for us in the church. We all have a story. And no one comes out perfectly clean in a conversation about sexuality. We all struggle with broken pasts, broken choices, or broken ideas and beliefs about how to navigate life as sexual beings. And some of you right now, you feel incredibly uncomfortable because this is not something that we typically talk about in church. And when we do, it's not done well. It's usually left at, hey, sex, not before marriage, moving on. And that's it. No context, no explanation, no anything. Many of us, we grew up in the heyday of purity culture, right? It was us and the Jonas Brothers wearing our purity rings. Like, oh, I can't have sex. I got this magic ring. I'm on lockdown. That ain't going to work. And although this was a really well-intentioned movement and had a good heart behind it, I truly believe what was intended for good became a megaphone for shame and confusion. And I remember when I was in college, I was reading story after story, countless of these open letters written by a lot of young people, predominantly women, but it was these people who had bought into all of the confusing messages that they received about sex from their church, from their small group, from their parents. And when they reached their wedding night, when they were ready to engage in this journey after years of diligently pursuing purity, they gave themselves fully to their spouse and spent the rest of the night weeping in the bathroom because they had never felt so dirty and so impure. This was intended for good, but it broke something. And in a sermon on this very topic, Pastor Ben Stewart put it this way, said it very well. He says, when we talk about sex, it's meant to be fun. But today, when we talk about sex, we see a wave of shame hit the room. And it is not supposed to be that way. And I want you to hear me now. Tonight, as we talk about God's design for sex and sexuality, my goal, my heart, this text is not meant to shame anybody. We all have broken pasts and wounds that may still be tender when it comes to how we've navigated our sexuality or maybe even still are. And when the Bible talks about sex, it's actually not in a tone of condemnation or shame. The Bible actually celebrates sex as a good gift from God, a gift that is maximized in the right context. And it's my hope that tonight we can actually reclaim some of that flourishing, some of that joy, some of that hope that God always intended for us in this area. Okay? Let's dive in. Turn with me to Song of Songs or Song of Solomon, chapter 4, if you haven't already. And it's kind of interesting. Throughout most of this book, we've been hearing from the young woman, from the bride. She's the primary speaker. But in chapter 4, we get to the wedding night, and all of a sudden, the husband, Solomon, jumps in. He's like, whoa, I got this. Let me talk about this one. Stand back. I'm on it. And it begins with a key word. It says, oh, look. Maybe it says behold in your Bible, or look with an exclamation point. It's a word in Hebrew that's used to call attention. Like, hey, everyone stop. You have to see this. It's actually the same word that Adam used in Genesis when he first saw Eve. I'm pretty sure the direct translation is, whoa. And in verse 1, he says, oh, you are beautiful, my darling. Oh, you are beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are like doves. Your hair is like a flock of female goats descending from Mount Gilead. I'm going to explain some of this. So he starts with this overwhelming exclamation that she is beautiful, which let me tell you, that's always a really good place to start, okay? Just if you're taking notes, start with that. Part of what makes sex so sacred is the vulnerability that's involved. That as you stand before this person with literally nothing in between you, every mole, every blemish, every scar, every little pocket of like, cellulite and stuff that we try to hide in all of our things. Every insecure part of your body is on display with this person. It's a very vulnerable thing for both men and women, but especially for women. There's a tremendous amount of pressure put on the female physical form to look a certain way in our culture. And that pressure is shaped by media, by pornography, by curated content that we see on Instagram. And so what does he do? He starts by affirming her. He starts by saying, I see you, and you are beautiful. We know she doesn't meet the beauty standards of the day because she told us back in chapter 1. Remember, she said, hey, my skin is dark and rough. I work in the fields. I'm out there doing manual labor, but I'm lovely on the inside. So she doesn't necessarily feel beautiful. But here he says, I don't care what the culture says. When I see you, I'm captivated. And he declares her to be beautiful in her entirety. But then he starts getting specific. Fellas, make a note. And he starts with her eyes. He compares them to doves, which we've talked about. Doves are a symbol of gentleness and of softness. He's saying, hey, there's a tenderness to her. Next, he compliments her hair, right? He compares it to a flock of female goats descending from Mount Gilead. Yes, that needs a little unpacking. At that time, Mount Gilead was the most beautiful place on earth to them. It's kind of, I guess it'd be like describing like Hawaii or something like that. It was this beautiful, lush oasis that was often used to symbolize healing and restoration. And the goats descending is meant to convey a sense of like of majesty. That as she's letting her hair down, she's letting it out of whatever, you know, fancy ornate design she had going on there. That as she's letting it down and as it tumbles down, he's saying, hey, it's really lush, it's majestic, it's beautiful. In verse 2, he talks about her teeth. He basically says, hey, they're white and they're there. Okay, so everyone brush your teeth. Hey, in an age when modern dentistry didn't exist, that's a huge plus, okay? We have modern dentistry, so just take care of yourself. In verse 3, he describes her mouth and her forehead. He says her lips are red. Her forehead is like a pomegranate. Now, this is not a recommended pickup line. Do not tell someone that they look like a pomegranate. Unless they're really crunchy, maybe that's awesome. But what he's saying is, hey, your complexion, your skin, it's youthful, it's vibrant, it's bright like a fruit. I notice at this point, they're just standing before each other, actually. The language communicates that they're just standing right in front of one another. And where has he started in these verses as he begins to unpack her beauty, as he begins to get specific? He started with her face and is moving down as he describes her beauty. Started with the eyes and is slowly moving down. What he doesn't do is immediately jump to, man, she's got a great booty, or complimenting her breasts or her legs or something like that. No, there's a sense of dignity. There's a sense of identity as he's looking in her face. He's seeing her as a person. So much of society's depiction of sexuality today in porn, media, and music reduces the whole of a person to disassociated body parts. And what it does is it turns people who are made in God's image into mere tools for our personal gratification. But that's not the picture that we see in this text. Here, there's dignity and wholeness. This is emphasized in verse 4. He says, your neck is like the Tower of David, built with courses of stones. 1,000 shields are hung on it, all shields of valiant warriors. Again, explanation. In that day, towers were a picture of strength, of dignity, and superior craftsmanship. What he's saying is, hey, you have a regal strength about you. That there's a healthy self-assurance and confidence that you have. He is reaffirming his respect for her. And this is a significant aspect that is largely missing from our culture today. Over the last decade, there have been several voices that have emerged across the globe examining and evaluating the cultural claims of sexual liberation and freedom that started back in the 60s and 70s. And this sexual revolution stated that, hey, if we liberate our sexual desire from these old constraints, marriage, all that, we would actually be promised more sex, better sex, more freedom, and more equality. And they tell us that sex is a natural urge, the same as just hunger or thirst, that it should be treated just as casually. We don't need all these restraints, all this other stuff, forget that. And it told young women that they should be able to have sex as freely and as emotionally detached as men, rather than addressing the way men were having sex and saying, hey, maybe we need to ship up and like be better. They said, no, women, we should be able to do the exact same thing that they're doing. This idea that no sex before marriage is an out-of-date, destructive burden to bear. And before we get too high and mighty, these messages aren't just in our culture, but have subtly invaded the church as well. Recent data shows that about 57% of Christians believe sex before marriage is acceptable. 36 among evangelicals, that's kind of the stream of believers that we're in. However, at the same time, 36 say it's acceptable. 42% actually reported having sex before marriage. So that's an interesting distinction. And then of those 42%, 80% regretted it. Among Gen Z Christians, 70 to 80% say sex before marriage is acceptable in certain situations. And 60 to 80% have actually had sex before their mid-20s. Amongst millennials, 70 to 85% have had sex before marriage, even though they believed it was wrong. And y'all, we see this here at Northwest. With more and more couples that I do and some of us do premarital counseling for, we've already had many discussions with people who are already living together or already sleeping together. We as a people, again, I don't say any of this to shame anybody, but to point out the reality that we as a people have largely bought into the culture's narratives. That sex, it's not that big of a deal. That it doesn't need restrictions around it. That it's not actually sacred. There's nothing special to it. However, statistics and trends and countless stories have shown the opposite to be true. In her book, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, British journalist and feminist author Louise Perry, she urges young women to take sex seriously, describing this idea of sexual disenchantment. She says it's the idea that sex is nothing more than a leisure activity, invested with meaning only if the participants choose to give it meaning. Proponents of this idea argue that sex has no intrinsic specialness, that it's not innately different from any other kind of social interaction. And she goes on to say, but when we attempt to disenchant sex and so pretend that this particular act is neither uniquely wonderful nor uniquely violating, then there's another kind of cost. And that cost falls disproportionately on women, the very people who were promised by the sexual revolution a better experience. And sadly, we see this is very much the case today, particularly with young men and young women. In 2016 and 2020, another author and New York Times contributor did almost 200 interviews with young men and young women between the ages of 15 and 22, people who said they were sexually active. And she was discussing their experience with and questions about sex and sexuality. She wrote two books that I recommend reading. One is Girls and Sex, the other is Boys and Sex. And in these, she describes specifically how oral sex specifically has become almost a guaranteed expectation of young women. But with the catch of them being the ones to perform oral sex, not receive it. She found that again and again, young women define sexual satisfaction not by achieving orgasm themselves, but by making sure their partner did. And later, she credited much of this with the influence of porn on both men and women in their sexual development, describing how in pornography, sex is portrayed as something that men do to rather than with women. That women exist primarily as providers of male orgasm, the goal of every encounter, that their own pleasure is presented as a performance to that end. And the men themselves, in porn, appear joyless and mechanical. And given its boundless novelty and availability, contemporary porn raises questions about how young people's erotic imaginations will be shaped long before they've even engaged in so much as a goodnight kiss. Right, the most innocent of things in regards to physical intimacy. Just a kiss goodnight holding someone's hand, that long before we even experience those innocent things, we have already been educated and trained that this is what sexuality is about. Naomi Wolf, who's a self-described liberal feminist. None of the people I'm quoting tonight actually are Christian either, by the way. They are all secular people, so I think that's worth knowing. Naomi Wolf, she's a scholar who studies sexual ethics and feminism. She had this to say about the impact of porn on our relationships. She said, young men and women are indeed being taught what porn is, how it looks, what its etiquette and expectations are, and it's all by pornographic training. And this is having a huge effect on how they interact. But the effect is not making men into these raving beasts. On the contrary, the onslaught of porn is responsible for deadening male libido in relation to real women and leading men to see fewer and fewer women as porn-worthy. Far from having to fend off porn-crazed young men, young women are worrying that mere flesh and blood can scarcely get, let alone hold, the attention of men. This should be deeply concerning for us, given that the most recent studies show that the average age of exposure to pornography in the U.S. is 11 to 13 years old. 93% of boys and 63% of girls are exposed before the age of 18. And with increasing technology and its access for kids, some studies find risks for kids as early as 8 years old. And that number is only getting lower and lower. The culture promised freer, better, more fulfilling sexual flourishing. But instead, it's delivered a world where women are commodities that exist only for the pleasure of men, where men are becoming less confident in their ability to interact with real women because media depicts women as NPC objects, where men and women alike are being discipled primarily by pornography, by Hollywood, and the internet, rather than God's word and the church when it comes to our sexuality. A world where families are breaking apart daily, and where the innocence of children is disappearing younger and younger every year. Make no mistake, y'all. The promises of the world, the sexual revolution, promised us liberation and freedom, but it has brought us shame, more confusion, more anxiety, more suffering, and even death. And I want you to hear me. If after hearing all of this, you're feeling some shame or some guilt for some things that you've participated in, if they play a role in your story, I want you to hear, I'm not blaming you. I'm not saying that's your fault. These are things that have been so pervasive and have flooded our reality. We have been inundated with these messages and these images our entire lives. I mean, you can't walk through the mall without seeing a 90-foot picture of a man or a woman posing seductively, right? Like, it's not like, oh, I'm seeking that out. It's the wall. If you're in the building, that's what you see, right? Like, that's it. I can't just look away, but where am I gonna go? That's it. That's all of the things. Our culture, it's saturated with this. And it's pushed these messages long before we even understood what were we even seeing. It's not your fault. But it is, sadly, our reality. Thankfully, it doesn't always have to be. Sex doesn't have to be a source of shame or guilt. In the right context, it actually affirms dignity and wholeness. Contrary to what we experience and hear in our culture, sex is not just a physical act. It's mental, it's emotional, and it's relational as well. And we see this reflected in the text. We're only 4 verses in, right? Because it's a poem, that's 17 lines. And the reality is Solomon hasn't actually even touched his wife yet. He won't actually even lay a single finger on her until verse 11. He starts this special, intimate moment together by speaking kindly and affirmingly to her. And this is a skill set that we need to cultivate. The ability to look deep down within ourselves, get in touch with our feelings, and express what's in our heart. Today, a lot of relationships or situationships start with the physical. They start with a hookup or a one-night stand. Maybe not that far. Maybe it's just, oh, this person's attractive. We should date. Done. Done deal. They're attractive. I'm attractive. Let's get together. And we like to focus on the easy parts. We like to get dressed up, look really good for the date, go on these really fun, exciting adventures, have a good meal. But we don't cultivate the skill of clear, honest, and vulnerable communication. Do you know that what is statistically, the first thing that goes in a marriage that plummets it towards divorce? Do you know what that is? It's kindness. It's kindness. Of all things, giving compliments and affirmation to each other, unsolicited. Doing things to help each other, just because. Kindness. So often, I see people, they get married, and after the honeymoon, they just become roommates. They just live together. And then when they get divorced, they say, well, we fell out of love. But no one falls out of love. I recently heard it put like this: you don't fall out of love like a fire doesn't fall out of heat, right? A fire doesn't just quit, like, oh, I don't know, I just fell out of heat, I'm done, I don't know what happened. No, it slowly dies out if it's not tended, if it's not cared for. It takes focus and intentionality to keep a fire going. You got to stoke it, you got to put some kindling in it, and it takes patience. You got to watch it, you got to stay on top of that thing, or it'll burn everything down or burn out. Dating and romance, they don't just end when you get married. Like, yes, I got that ring. Thank God that hard part's over. Now we just do the rest of our life thing. No. And look, I'm going to tell you a secret. Both men and women actually really desire romance. The women part's not so surprising. But men actually really desire romance. And they actually, like, really want to be romantic. Ladies, this is good news, okay? This lady, this researcher named Sean T. Felden, found that men want to be romantic. The problem is there's three obstacles that kind of get in their way, that shut them down, okay? Number one is they're scared that they won't do it right, okay? Right with quotation marks. They're scared that if they get flowers, they're gonna get the wrong kinds of flowers, and that's gonna be called out. They're scared if they get chocolates, it's gonna be the wrong chocolates, and that's gonna be shut down. They're scared that I'm gonna try and like do this poetic thing and say these good words, and they're like, and I'm terrible at it, and I'm worried it's just gonna fail, and I'm gonna look stupid. It's a real thing. Number two, they're haunted by past failures, right? They tried to be romantic and it did not go well. Or they tried to do something they thought was romantic and beautiful and the person just thought they were being creepy. Because y'all, the line between romance and creepy is 100% subjective, okay? I do not care what anyone tells you. It is all about how do you think about that person, right? So there's that. And it's harder for men, it's not impossible, but it's harder for men to switch their brain from work to play. So it's hard sometimes if you've been on a date out like in the middle of the week during a work day and they're like, man, they're just not really here. Like, what's going on? It's naturally harder for us as men to move from our work logic, doing everything box to our feelings box, okay? Like, that's just a harder thing. So again, not impossible. These are not things you can't overcome, but they are there. The good news is men do want to be romantic. They desire that. And they desire to be romanced too, is what she found in her book, which is crazy. That's a whole different topic, a whole different talk. But it's good. Like, that's a beautiful thing. And romance is a skill, okay? It takes effort. You may not always get it perfect, guys or girls, but don't stop trying, okay? Because the moment we stop trying for connection, well, that's the moment that we lose it, right? Casual hookup culture leaves this aspect out. It just tells us, hey, sex, it's just physical, it's casual, emotions, feelings, that's all unnecessary, that's undesired, we don't want to catch feelings, no, no. But research shows that that just isn't the case. Christine Emba, who's a journalist, she notes in her book, Rethinking Sex, Women in particular are actually far less likely to experience orgasm in hookup culture. Casual sex is more focused on the male desires. Women are not taught to communicate their desires or preferences in casual hookup culture. And there's this immense pressure to act like a porn star in the bedroom and engage in acts that are really commonly associated with porn. One of the most would be including bondage and choking. There's 58% of young adult women recently who said that they have been choked during sex. Now, you can get into the whole consent discussion. There's a lot in that. But that breaks my heart. That's not cool. And I know we live in a day and a time when no one can question anybody's kink or whatever, but there's some things that are just objectively not okay. All of this is building into these overall themes of there being a lack of safety, a lack of emotional connection, and care, just human care. So I'm gonna talk to the guys in the room for just a quick moment. All my fellas, all my brothers in the room, good to see you, glad you're here. Good to see you. There may come a day, okay, I'm looking at this table, there's no fellas over here, look over here. There may come a day when God allows you to join your life to one of his daughters, right? That might happen. And when you get married and you're excited to enter into this sexual journey with this person, I want you to hear me. You be gentle with your wife, okay? You be gentle. The honeymoon is not our time to act out all of our wildest sexual desires and fantasies, all right? Your wife, her body is not our sexual playground to use to satisfy our desires. I don't care what John Mayer says. I don't care how catchy the song is, right? That's not what that's about. You approach that moment, that experience, with lots of gentleness and lots of tenderness and care, okay? We see this, actually, in verses 5 and 6. In verse 5, it says, your two breasts are like two fawns. Told y'all, spicy. Here we go. Twins of the gazelle grazing among the lilies. Until the dawn arrives and the shadows flee, I will go up to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. So, a fawn, if you don't know, that is a young deer, okay? A doe, a deer, female deer. This is a young deer, baby deer. And fawns were often used to depict grace and beauty in the Bible, but they were also a picture of gentleness. Okay, I don't know if you know this, but deer are very, very, like, skittish, right? They're easily scared creatures. Several years ago, Casey and I got the opportunity to go to one of our former elders' lake house that they had. They're like, hey, y'all need a break, go pull away for the weekend. It's way up somewhere else in Texas, West Texas. And one of the cool things about this area was they had a lot of deer, and they had a huge, like, multi-gallon, like, industrial trash can full of deer feed. It's like, that's obsessive, but okay, great. So they're like, no, it's really great. You just throw this out in the yard, and they'll come, and you can just sit, and you can watch. It's beautiful. So we did that, and I kid you not, like, 30 deer were as close as I am to y'all. Like, it was like if the well was full of deer right now. That is what it was like. And it was really funny because at one point, like, we were trying not to make a sound or anything. At one point, one of the deer sneezed, and they all lost their ever-loving mind. I mean, it was like a gunshot went off. They all took off. Two of them smacked into each other. Like, they flipped out, okay? They're really skittish. They're really scared creatures. If you rush up to manhandle a fawn, like, hey, fawn, let me come hug you. Let me come be sweet with you. It's not going to go well, okay? Let me just tell you that. Gentleness. So as he's preparing to approach her, he does so with gentleness and care, and so too should we approach one another, okay? In verse 7, he reaffirms again that she is overall lovely in his eyes. He says, you are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no blemish in you. Okay, again, here, he's not just describing her physical appearance, actually. He's actually using Old Testament temple imagery. In the Old Testament, when sacrifices were brought to the temple to atone for the sins of the people, you couldn't just bring any old random roadkill that you found that day. It was a sacrifice. This was meant to atone, to show the deep loss that our sin incurs against God. And so to symbolize our understanding of that, you had to bring something that would bring loss for you. So you would bring the best of the best of your flock, of your livelihood. And that's what he's saying to her. You are the best of the best to me. And y'all, we can't remind each other of that truth enough, right? We all need to hear that. Nothing brings up more insecurity in a relationship than sex. I'm just going to tell you all this. It is fun, it is an adventure, but man, it will bring up some hard, hard conversations and all kinds of stuff in your heart, which is why we need the safety and the trust that is the foundation of marriage that we talked about last time. Because that committed bond, that bond that says, I am all for you as long as I live, that I am committing myself to loving you, not just on our wedding day or our honeymoon, not just when you wear that particular outfit, when you're at your most beautiful or your sexiest, but when you're sick, when you actually do things that hurt me deeply, that I will never stop chasing after you, that I will never stop caring for you, that I will never give up on us. That is the kind of commitment that we can freely give ourselves to. No fear, no shame. And we see this in the next couple of verses as he invites her into this journey together. In verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's dens and the mountain haunts of the leopards. You've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. Quick aside, this my sister, my bride thing, don't get hung up on that. He's not saying that they're literally their sister, and don't throw in the argument of like, well, culturally, it was a little bit different back then. No, that's not what he's saying at all, okay? This idea of my sister, my bride, in their culture, family played a massive, massive role. Like, that was your inner circle, was your family. They were tight-knit. You literally would live and die your entire life all as one family in one little compound. All your little tents and your shacks would all be around, connected next to each other. It was not like how we live now, where we move away from family. No, you lived with your family generation after generation after generation. So when he calls her his sister, his bride, and he's going to do that a lot, so don't get freaked out by that. What he's doing is saying, hey, you are family to me. You are one of my trusted, closest relationships that I could possibly have on this earth. Let's just get that out of the way. Okay, so he talks about Mount Lebanon. Mount Lebanon is referenced over 70 times in the Old Testament. Again, this was a majestic mountain range that served as the border to the Promised Land. And he's noting that there's physical distance between us, right? He's picturing, hey, you're way up on this mountain where like the lions are and the tigers and the bears, like all those things. I want you to come down to me. He's inviting her to cross the distance with him. Again, he's not rushing up to her. He's not like, you're on the mountain and I'm climbing up that mountain. I'm coming. Here we go. No, he's saying, hey, would you come down to me? Would you come and do this journey with me? And what's important about this is he's helping her retain her agency and her choice. He's reminding them both that, hey, this is something that we do with each other, not to each other. So I'm going to invite, but I'm not going to force. You respond, and we'll do this thing together. And she does. And we read in verse 10 and 11, he says, how delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. See, there it is again, but now we're not freaked out. How much better is your love than wine? The fragrance of your perfume is better than any spice. Your lips drip sweetness like the honeycomb, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. So they're kissing now. And as they do, he uses promised land language. What did God describe the promised land as? A land flowing with milk and honey, right? And this conveys a sense of sweetness, right? Milk and honey, both sweet. It's nourishing. These are good vitamins. It's good for you. And it's delightful, right? It's fun. It's fun to have honey on things. Milk tastes good. Like, it's meant to be a good, beautiful thing. But also, it conveys life. Because honey and milk are two of the only animal products that we eat that don't require for an animal to die. Nothing has to be lost in that. He's saying that what we are enjoying with each other, hey, it's sweet, and it's really good, and it doesn't require a death on anybody's part. And that's how sex should be. Sex is meant to be a delight. It is not a chore. It's not a regret. And the next section, he compares her to a locked garden. Verse 12, he says, "You are a locked garden, my sister, my bride. You're an enclosed spring, a sealed up fountain. Your shoots are a royal garden full of pomegranates. Man loves his fruit. Henna with nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon with every kind of spice, myrrh and aloes with all the finest spices. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water flowing down from Lebanon." So this is a picture of inaccessibility, and really it's a picture of like of her virginity. That when we think of a garden, we kind of think of like, you know, a little spit of grass and some seeds in it. And we're like, ooh, garden, look, tomatoes. That's not what they were picturing. When they talk about a garden, it's like the Garden of Eden, right? It's a lush oasis, that it's this beautiful, life-giving, sustaining thing. And he's saying, hey, your sexuality, it's a refreshing place of life and beauty. But it's locked, he says, right? And again, he isn't forcing his way in. He isn't saying, I want to hit that. I want to get that. He doesn't dehumanize her. He acknowledges the preciousness of what she is choosing to share with him in the safety of their commitment together. And in verse 16, she does. It says, "Awake, O north wind, come, O south wind, blow on my garden so that its fragrant spices may send out their sweet smell. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its delightful fruit." Does anybody need me to translate that for you? Basically saying, hey, let's get it on. I'm ready. Game on. Let's do this thing. To which I'm sure he said, yes, ma'am. So in chapter 5, we should talk a little bit about the beginning of chapter 5. It happens sometime after, okay? We don't know how much longer after. Maybe 10 minutes, maybe an hour, maybe 10 seconds. We don't know. But it says, "I've entered my garden, O my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my balsam spice. I've eaten my honeycomb and my honey, and I have drunk my wine and my milk." And the language here, it shifts to past tense, presumably as they're laying there together, enjoying the goodness and the sweetness of this journey together. But there's one more thing that I want us to see before we close for tonight. Verse 1 of chapter 5 actually ends with a different voice speaking. It's not the husband, it's not the wife. And this voice says, "Eat, friends, and drink. Drink freely, O lovers." Which sounds so Shakespearean, like, and I love that. There's some debate over to who exactly is actually speaking here. Some think that it's actually God speaking over them, saying, hey, what you've chosen to do, it's good and it's beautiful and I approve of this thing. Many others believe that it's actually a callback to their community from chapters 1 and 2. And this serves as a picture of how God designed sex to be, that it isn't meant to be something shameful that we have to be secretive about, right? That in the right context, it can be celebrated, and not just by us, but by our whole community. That we don't have to hide this part of our lives, but can appropriately celebrate it and encourage it. Because love with restraint leads to shameless delight. So, as the band comes back up, anybody need some water? Need to cool off a little bit? I want to close with this. Our sexuality isn't the problem. It's not. For too long, the church has been too uncomfortable to enter into honest discussions about God's picture and purpose of sex. And in our silence, we've allowed culture to become our chief educator. And that's led to the pain of so many. A culture that promised freedom and thriving, but has only delivered suffering. Time magazine recently wrote, "There is no single force causing as much measurable hardship and human misery in this country as the collapse of marriage." That it hurts children, it reduces mothers' financial security, and has landed with particular devastation on those who can bear it the least, the nation's underdogs. On every single significant outcome related to short-term well-being and long-term success, children from intact two-parent families outperform those from single-parent households. Longevity, drug abuse, school performance, dropout rates, teen pregnancy, criminal behavior, incarceration. If you can measure it, a sociologist has, and in all cases, the kids living with both parents drastically outperform others, even when you adjust for economic standards and differences. And yo, that's Time Magazine, okay? That's not Christianity Today. That's a secular outlet that is proclaiming what God always has from the beginning. That there is something sacred. There is something special about being image bearers of God. That we were made to live in relationship with others, not to use others for our personal gain. That sex isn't just sex. It isn't just a physical itch. That it's actually an echo of something far deeper, of something more, of something sacred. In his book called Better Story, author Glenn Harrison describes how, in fact, the biblical picture of marital sexual union is nothing less than an anticipation of an even deeper union with the divine. And whether we're married or single in this life, sexual desire is our inbuilt homing instinct for the divine, a kind of navigation aid showing us the way home. You could think of it as a form of body language. Our bodies talk to us about a greater reality of fulfillment and eternal blessing and urges us to go there. Sex and marriage are not the most important aspects of our existence. They're a picture. They're a picture that points us back to the only one who can satisfy the deep longings of our souls. The reality is that all of us have broken beliefs and ideas when it comes to our own sexuality, myself included. I am a man of unclean lips. I am no better than any of you. And some of us feel like we've done all the right things, and God owes us a spouse and a thriving sexual life as a reward. Others of us in the room, hey, we carry some regret and some guilt for some choices that we've made, maybe that we're still making. And some of us carry shame for things that happened to us that we did not choose. Some of us, we haven't followed after God's picture of sex, and we've been told that it's too late for us now. That we're dirty, we're broken, that we're irredeemable. And I want to remind all of us, that is not the gospel of Jesus. We don't follow a God who measures our worth by our performance. Because the truth is, we all fail. We all fail, we all have, and we will continue to fall short. The good news is that because of Jesus, we can rise again. We just celebrated this past weekend with Easter, that if we choose him, if we choose Jesus, he can restore us in ways we never thought possible. Pastor Ben Stewart describes how the only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. We can't just focus on the negativity of our broken desires. We also need to let ourselves be swept up by the beauty of our sanctified ones. Any unhealthy thing that is holding your attention today can be overwhelmed with something better. And he says, your addictions lose their allure in the light of God's affections. Amen. No matter what mistakes you've made, and no matter what false beliefs you have carried, they do not define you. If you love Jesus, his love, his grace, his mercy and compassion are what define you. And that is a love that knows no bounds. The reason God built us with sexual desires is so that we would understand the depth of passion that God has for us. For us to be intimately connected with him at the deepest level of our being. To be fully seen in all of our flaws and all of our beauty. And to be chosen, to be cherished, to be respected and loved without shame, without guilt, without hesitation, a love with no limits, with no restraint, a love that is truly boundless. And that is a love that is truly worth trusting. So let's end tonight by standing and celebrating the boundless love that our God has for us tonight.